So welcome everyone to a new quantum gravity seminar, PI. This week we have the pleasure to have Mahdi Goddadzka from Queen Mary University in London. And he's gonna tell us about asymptotic charges in gravity. And so I let Mahdi take it away.
Thank you, Daniele. And thanks for the invitation to speak. So today I'm going to talk about work that I've been doing with Hardy Goddadzka, Malcolm Perry, and Chris Pope. And it's something that we've been interested in for the past 2 or 3 years now. And so for today's talk, I think that the sort of, from my perspective, the most interesting part of this is the relation to true contributions to BMS charges, which you can sort of think of as a complexification of the BMS group. So I'll talk a bit about that. What I've tried to do is to really give a very basic talk and give the general ideas. And if you're interested, you can go and have a look at the papers that we've put out over the past 2 or 3 years. So I do apologize to people who know more about this subject than I do. So, I mean, it will be simple. So I hope the experts in the audience don't get too bored. So I should say that in addition to our papers, there are also these two papers, the first one, which are also very recent and related subjects. The first one by the some of the people in PI, so Laurent Friedel, Mark Geiler, Daniele Pranzetti, and this one which came out this month by Roberto Oliveri and Simone Speziale. So they're also on related issues. Okay, so let me begin with a sort of introduction. And please do just unmute yourself and ask questions whenever you have any. So with some introduction and motivation. So what we've been primarily interested in are asymptotically flat space times. So let me just take some time to explain what these are. So basically, the way I'm going to define asymptotically flat space time is that there exist Bondi coordinates. So u, r, x, I, where, you know, one should really think of these as basically angular coordinates, such that the metric takes the Bondi form, which I'm sure most of you will be familiar with. So we have essentially these functions, f, beta, HIJ, well, these are tensors on the sort of the two sphere, the two space should, the two space and the C. And furthermore, sort of these have a particular fall off for large R. So this is for large R. You can sort of, the F starts off as one and then it's drops off as one over R, where this F zero just depends on U and X. Beta falls off as one over R squared. And the CI falls off as also 1 over r squared, and hij starts off with the metric on the round 2 sphere, and then there's a 1 over r correction. And furthermore, we have the freedom to choose the determinant of H to just be the determinant of gamma. And of course, this is just sine squared theta. Okay, so this is the setting that we're going to be working with. And you can sort of think of it as representing an isolated system, gravitational system. And you have this system being observed at infinity, basically. So that's at infinity, the space looks like Minkowski. That's the general idea. And if you want to think of it in terms of Penrose diagrams, so essentially what you have is a structure of this form where you have a null null infinity, future null infinity. You have space like infinity, which corresponds to this coordinate u being minus infinity, and time like infinity with u corresponding to plus infinity. And large r is taking you towards future null infinity. So that's basically what we're interested in. And so because of this fact that as r increases, as r becomes very large, we're sort of, you know, you can, this is basically looks like the Penrose diagram for Minkowski, right? So we're approaching Minkowski space in some sense. A question that one can ask is, well, what is the symmetry group at large r? Or equivalently, what is the asymptotic symmetry group for this class of spacetimes? Okay. So
can I ask maybe
sure.
It's Laurent. Hello, Maddie. I have a question. So I agree with everything you say. It's an isolated system at infinity. I hope we agree on the fact that this is not the most general system you can put at infinity. That is, I hope we agree that to go to the Bondi frame, you have to restrict the asymptotic symmetry group to be a subgroup of the true physical symmetry group.
Indeed.
Okay. So what you're going to describe is not really the gravity. So BMS group is not the full symmetry group. Agree on that?
Is not the full symmetry group of what, sorry?
Of asymptotically flat spacetimes.
So why'd you say that?
Because, you know, if you want to have the full asymptotic group, you need to include super rotations, for instance.
Oh, in that
sense. That is here, you have chosen you see, when you fix coordinate at infinity, you have to distinguish whether this coordinate choice you're fixing a symmetry or a gauge, right? And when you fix the body frame, you're fixing some stuff you're fixing are not gauge; they're really symmetry transformations. So therefore, you're restricting the boundary symmetry group.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. In that sense, I agree. But Maybe I'll explain, and then if you sort of you can come back.
Quick clarification. It's just the expression for beta, is that 1 plus beta 0 over r squared?
No, it's really 1 over r squared. It begins with 1 over r squared.
Oh, I was just confused because I thought the coefficient for du squared should go to 1 at large r.
Yeah, so beta basically goes to 0, so the exponential goes to 1, and then f goes like 1.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Okay, so then the I guess modular what Laurent said, the asymptotic symmetry group here is BMS, which you can think of as SL2C semi-direct supertranslations, where these are global conformal transformations on S2. Although I think this is what Laurent was referring to. One can think of sort of local conformal symmetries on S2 and so on. And this is something that Glenn Barnick and Cedric Tressart have been thinking about and you initiated, but I'm not going to really discuss that. In fact, in this talk, for the most part, I'm really going to be focusing on the supertranslation part, because this is the, in some sense, the most interesting part of these asymptotic symmetries. And these you can think of as being generated by angle-dependent functions. So just to maybe, I know that it doesn't make sense to compare this to Poincaré, but just because I made the I referred to Minkowski earlier, you can sort of, I mean, this is homomorphic to Lorentz group, so you can think of this as the Lorentz part. And if you take the L equals zero and L equals one normal subgroup of these supertranslations, you would have four sort of generates, which you can think of as somehow the usual translations. Okay, and then so we have this setup, and what we're sort of, what Noether told us a long time ago is as soon as you have sort of symmetry generators, you have sort of charges. So the question is, well, what are the charges in this situation? Okay. And that's basically what we're going to be interested in. Okay, and so before I sort of delve into that, let me just, I don't need to motivate this so much for this audience, but let me sort of just do so anyway. Why should we be interested in this sort of setup and in these sort of questions? So I'll start off with some general motivations, and then I'll mention what got me interested in this. And I guess the sort of oldest motivation comes from the work of Ashtekar and his whole sort of asymptotic quantization. So the general idea is that if you're keen to learn about the quantum theory, then it makes sense to first study the classical theory and its phase space. So that's the oldest, if you like, motivation for it. Recently, there's been a lot of interest in this. There's been a sort of somewhat of a resurgence in part of the community related to these questions, which has mainly been driven by Andy Strominger, who sort of argued that there's a link to all this with soft graviton scattering. So somehow that the BMS group shows up when considering soft graviton scattering, and in particular the Weinberg soft theorem. I mean, I'm not going to discuss all this here. I'm just giving some sort of brief motivations for this. And as far as at least one of my collaborators is concerned. So Malcolm Perry, the reason why he got interested in these rule charges and so on was because of some work that he initiated with Stephen Hawking, so himself and Andy Strominger. And this is sort of applying all these ideas to black holes, which again, I'm not going to discuss. Okay. So this is why some people in the community are interested in these questions. For me, the main interest that I had at looking at this was to understand Newman-Penrose charges. So maybe I should just write Newman-Penrose charges and their relation to at the BMS group. Okay. So what are Newman-Penrose charges? So in 1968, what Newman and Penrose showed was that there are 10 nonlinear conserved charges at Scribe Plus. So you have basically charges that live at Scribe Plus and are U independent, as in their U derivative is zero, so they're strictly conserved. And there was very surprising result, and a lot of people didn't really know what to do with it. I encountered them during my PhD and I was always fascinated by them. So when this whole sort of BMS story became popular after Strominger's work, for me, there was that sort of going back and saying, well, you know, is there this relation between Newman-Penrose charges and BMS group? And so that's why I got interested in this. And in fact, with Hardy and Chris, what we found was a relation between Newman-Penrose charges and the BMS group, but there was a necessity of having dual BMS charges so we found that the Newman-Penrose charges fit into, can be described in relation to the BMS group, but one really needs to consider these sort of objects which hadn't really appeared in much of the literature, at least in connection to asymptotic leaf flat space times. And these you can think of as sort of generalizations of the nut charge, okay? So in fact, the comparison would be the standard BMS charges are generalizations of the Bondi mass or Fermat. Okay, so this is the sort of relation between them. And so in fact, just before lockdown, I went to Oxford to give a seminar. I mean, that was before the work with Malcolm and Hardy. It was mainly to talk about this, and Roger Penrose was there, and he was actually telling me how, you know, after they published this paper, there was a lot of skepticism from the community that people sort of either thought that, that what they'd done was wrong or that it was just useless because it wasn't clear what was going on, how they were related to these newly found BMS groups. And in fact, there's a footnote in that paper where they say, you know, these must be related to the BMS group and we'll deal with this in a future paper, but they somehow never did. So he was certainly very happy that we'd taken up these charges, which had been long neglected. And so with Hardy and Malcolm, what we really wanted to address was a Hamiltonian derivation of these joule BMS charges. So really to derive them from the Einstein theory, which is what we did. Okay, so that's the sort of motivation. I'll give a brief outline. So what I'll do initially is to explain briefly what the covariant phase space formalism is about, which is the formalism that we're going to use to address this question. Then I'll explain what the theory is. So spoiler alert. So we're going to use first order formalism. So the first order Palatini action with a so-called Hall's term. I'll explain what all this is. Then I'll briefly discuss what we get out of this, combining this formalism with this theory, and finish with some conclusions. Okay, so that's the general idea. Are there any questions before I move on? Okay, if not, I realized that I guess we started a bit late. So maybe I've just been talking for 20 minutes. Anyway, so let me talk about covariant phase space. So this goes back to, in fact, Piles and Bergman, Schiller. So this is sort of 50s, I think it's 53. And then many people have contributed and looked at this, but at least for me, I guess it's really associated with Bob Wald and his collaborators. So Lee Wald, Aya Wald, Wald Zupas, and this brief review that I do is very much inspired by their account of this. So I should say there's also Krunkovich and Witten who also looked at this. Anyway, so what we do here is that we have some theory, we have some fields, phi, and we have a Lagrangian.
Mehdi, maybe can I just
sure.
There's a guy that is often not accredited for the invention of that, and he's really the father of that. It's the Polish school, so Kijowski, Gavetsky, they did everything way before Wald, and often they are not cited.
I see.
But the Polish school in the 60s, 70s, 80s, they really did everything. And I kind of don't understand why they're forgotten when people talk about Wald. Wald did it, but much after. And sometimes not.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, indeed.
As what these guys did.
Yeah, so I hadn't appreciated quite their contributions, but as I said, a lot of people have been involved, at least.
Yeah. But this school, Kijowski, they really kind of, for 15 years they developed the entire.
Okay, well, that's good. Thank you.
They're often forgotten, anyway, since you seem to care about that. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. So we have a Lagrangian L, which is a top form. And so then, you know, it's the sort of standard thing that we've been doing since undergrad. You're given a Lagrangian, you vary it in order to find the equations of motion. And in order to get it into this form, what you're doing is sort of integrating by parts, which give you boundary terms. So these are the sort of terms that you obtain by integrating by parts. So these are the equations of motion. And this is what's called the presymplectic potential. So presymplectic because we don't really have a phase space here. In principle, in order to get the phase space, we need to mod out by proper gate transformations, which you can think of as degenerate directions in this presymplectic space. But the whole point of the covariant phase space formalism is precisely not to mod out by these proper gate transformations so that everything remains covariant. So from this presymplectic potential, we define a presymplectic form. So, which is basically just the exterior derivative in phase space. Again, I'm using the word phase space with rather loosely of the presymplectic potential. Okay. So this is the expression for this. So this is a two form on phase space. And then generally, you know, from sort of classical mechanics, from Arnold's book or whatever, we know that a Hamiltonian flow is defined as something that, so if we introduce a local phase space coordinates AB, what defines a Hamiltonian flow is the following equation. So you take the symplectic two form, you contract it with some direction in phase space, and this is a Hamiltonian vector or a Hamiltonian direction if and only if this combination gives back an exact one form on phase space. And so this is the Hamiltonian, which is conjugate to this direction, okay? And in fact, you know, if you introduce a Darbo frame, this is precisely the Hamilton's equations, right? So in our language, if we translate that to the language we've been using so far, which is more of a sort of space-time covariant language, what this translates to, this equation above, is the variation of some quantity H is the integral of the symplectic two form with one leg along some specific direction, okay? So you have some tau that generates particular transformation that leads to to a Hamiltonian. And what we're going to be interested in, diffeomorphisms. So here we really want to think of this delta tau as lead derivative along some diffeomorphism generator C. Okay. And in this case, what we can show is that the symplectic two form on shells. So if you include the equations of if you use the equations of motion, can be written as an exact form. So the exterior derivative in space time, I should add. Where, so this is the symplectic potential. This is just an inner product. And this is usually called the Noether charge, because in global theories, this would be the Noether charge. And there's the sort of associated Noether current, which is the exterior derivative of this Noether charge, which equals this quantity here. Okay, so this is really sort of the Noether theorem is really apparent here, obviously in a setting in which you have local symmetries. And if you've never seen this before or done this before, I encourage you to go away and derive this relation. It's really sort of a simple and nice relation. And the thing that you use is the Cartan magic formula, which is that the lead derivative is given by this combination. Okay, and so if we use this expression now, then that equation that we had above, this equation, in for the case of diffeomorphisms, becomes, so using Stokes' theorem, we can, the integral becomes the integral on the boundary of this Cauchy surface, delta Q C minus this object here. Okay. So that's essentially what we end up with. And so if we look at the integrability condition for this, so see if we can integrate this to leave a true Hamiltonian, it's fairly easy to see that this just boils down to the integral of inner product of the of Xi with the symplectic two form. And this is certainly not zero in general. So the idea is that generally this equation cannot be integrated. And the reason for that is that you have flux, okay? So you have flux that's going to null infinity, which basically means that you don't have a conserved quantity. So, and this is something that Walt Zupas discussed in length. So the way to view this thing, the left-hand side, is in terms of an integrable part. So I'm actually going to, So this is generally not integrable. So I use this notation delta slash, which and then this can be decomposed into an integrable part and a non-integrable part. And okay, so again, Walt Zupas discussed how to separate these different terms, because obviously there's a redundancy here. You can add sort of bits and take it away. You can add to the integrable charge and take it away with n. So this we think of as a charge. Sorry, my phone is ringing. And this is the non-integrable bit, which is related to flux. Okay. So that's how we get charges associated with generators with diffeomorphisms, which are not proper gate transformations. So we basically look at those diffeomorphisms which are improper gate transformations or Killing isometries, and then that gives us an associated integrable charge and some non-integrable pieces, which we can think of as describing flux and null infinity. So if we go back to the original setup we had of asymptotically flat space times and think about BMS charges, then what we find if we do that calculation, so where C belongs to BMS transformations, we find an expression of this form, and it's a rather long expression, but I'm just going to write it down so that you have some idea of what one gets. So just to be clear, what the way we've derived this is taken this general expression, take Einstein-Hilbert action, find the presymplectic potential, that's this theta, find the Noether charge, put it all together, and you get this object here. So this is really the Bondi metric, the Bondi form that I wrote down earlier. And this is what you get. And again, a lot of people have looked at this question, but I guess for me, at least the most obvious manifestation of this is with Iowald. And if we look at a leading order expression for this, so leading order in 1 over R, then this becomes something which hopefully will not look too alien to people. So again, I'm just focusing on super translations parameterized by this S, which is a function, a general function of the angular coordinates. So this mess simplifies to this thing here. This is the non-integrable piece, okay? It's basically what I called N before. This object here is the bond in use. So you really see that the fact that the flux comes into this expression. And if we set S to be 1, then this is just the Bondi mass. Well, this is just the Bondi mass aspect. Or Bondi Trautmann mass aspect. And if we set S equals to 1, which you can think of as sort of taking the global charge, this just gives M. Okay, which you expect. And if you take it to be S to be an L equals 0 and L equals 1 mode, then it's the Bondi-Trautmann form momentum. Okay, so, but what about nut charges? Where do they come into this? And so that's essentially what the question that we asked. And sort of after a lot of thought, we realized that the way to get them is by looking at first order formalism and adding a term which doesn't affect the equations of motion. So the initial paper that I referenced at the start by Laurent, Marc, and Daniele also emphasized this aspect of having terms in the Lagrangian which don't contribute to the equations of motion do lead to sort of significant they should not be ignored. And this is something that we found also. So we looked at first order, plus we added what's known as a Hulse term. I think actually that what I'm going to call Palatini-Hulse term, I think generally in the literature is referred to as Hulse theory, but I'm just going to use this nomenclature. So the theory is described by this action. Where this P, so A, B, C, D are tangent space indices, where this is a half epsilon A, B, C, D plus I lambda to A, D. So this is the Palatini part, which we can also call the electric part in analogy with electromagnetism. This is the Hulse part, which we can call the magnetic. And it's a bit of a spoiler alert because this is what's gonna in the end give us the true charges. And this lambda, this lambda is just some parameter, arbitrary parameter. That we won't, I'll discuss this parameter at the end, but we won't talk about too much.
Can we say that it's usually called the Imirzi parameter?
Indeed, so yes, indeed. Yeah, indeed. Okay, and then so these E's are the fear binds. So basically the metric given by their square. I'm not going to write down the form of these. I mean, there's no point, but they're the fear binds that give the when you square them, give the Bondi metric. Okay, so, and in this case, before when I described the whole BMS story, there's an added sort of structure here, which is that we have Lorentz transformations that play a role as well. And in fact, what we found is that they decouple from what I'm about to say. So as far as we're concerned, we can just ignore them. In fact, Roberto Oliveri and Simone Speziale in their recent paper have a very nice discussion about this. But I'm just going to ignore it for now. You can look at either our paper or their paper for more details about this. Okay, so we have our theory, and then the question is, okay, let's apply it to this covariant phase space handle. Let's crank the handle and see what we get. So we initially we need to start by, so I'll just check what time is. So the pre-symplectic potential can be found. So the electric part So in fact, these expressions that I'm writing down, Simone Speziale had them in his papers as well. He'd actually looked at this theory and the covariant space sort of story for this theory as well. And the magnetic part is, okay, I mean, you can just guess what it is given the form of P. I'll just write it down. And then from these, we get the Noether. Charges associated to these, so QE 2. So it's a fairly straightforward calculation, and then we put all these together and we get the contributions to the Hamiltonian. Which take a fairly simple form. So this unsurprisingly reduces to the expression that I wrote earlier. I mean, we expect the standard charges to be the same whether you're considering Palatini or Einstein-Hilbert. So that's it's good that we get that. And then the magnetic part, or the sort of dual part, is of this very simple form. And then when we compare it to the expression that we had before, myself, Hardy, and Chris had found, when looking at Newman-Pembroke's charges, that this matches that. So essentially, it reproduces what we'd found earlier. Okay, and the leading order, if we look at this, what we find is that the integrable charge associated with these dual charges with the magnetic contribution is of this form. So where this C flat, the index down, is just the C zero J that I mentioned at the start, just with the index lowered. And if we set S to be one, this is just a null charge, okay, which is something that's been studied in the literature, I guess, since the 60s. Okay, so you can think of these as somehow generalizations of that sort of.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
If I look at your tilde charge, maybe a little bit higher, can you show it?
Sorry.
So it looks like it's integrable all the time, which means there's never any flux of dual charge.
For this one?
Yeah.
There is a non-integrable piece, actually. So the non-integrable piece is exactly the same as exactly the same. It's very reminiscent of the non-integrable piece for the standard one. So the Bondi news comes into it again. But rather interestingly, what you have is that whereas if you take the expression for the standard one and look at it in terms of a sort of conservation equation, look at it in terms of taking the Bondi mass and looking at its derivative and showing that it matches the Bondi flux at infinity. Here, if you do the same story, even though there's a non-integrable part, the flux will vanish, so you will have a conserved node charge.
That's true only for the global one, right?
For the global one, that's right.
Okay. Can you is it easy to write down what the flux looks like for the dual charge?
The sort of you mean this bit? It's basically of the form.
The Bondi, yeah, with the Bondi flux, yeah.
It's basically of this form, where the only difference with the previous expression is this C tilde, where C tilde is a sort of twist. So you take the volume form on the sphere, and you can track.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a very interesting structure. We talk about this briefly in a paper with Hardy and Chris, which is called a sort of, what's it called? I've forgotten now, but it's from last year. It's about a sort of soft nut charges. We discussed that a bit there. But it does have an interesting structure. I realized that I think I have 10 minutes left, but I think that's basically all I really want to say. So the sort of conclusion is that by looking at first order tetrad formalism, we could derive from the Einstein theory the set of dual charges which we'd sort of derived by, you know, when we looked at Newman-Penrose charges. The way we got these was that we realized we needed them to reproduce Newman-Penrose charges, and then we realized that they're actually consistent charges, that there's no reason why they shouldn't exist. But it's nice to actually get them from the Einstein theory. At this point, I would refer you to this recent paper of Oliveri and Speziale, because we talk a bit about this as well, but they really explain very well the fact that all this is really arising from the fact that the presymplectic potential has this ambiguity that you can just add exact forms. There's a very nice discussion of that in their paper. And this is essentially the reason why, you couldn't do it. These didn't appear in the metric formulation, but they do in the first order. And in fact, they showed that if you consider second order Fierbein formulation, you still won't get this out. So you really requires the first order formalism. So I guess that's about all I wanted to say. But let me just finish with some remarks. The first one is that while I focused on Joule charges, I think what this, and it's in the spirit of this paper of Friedel, Geil, and Pranzetti, that what this sort of suggests is a general approach whereby one really a general approach to charges, whereby the slogan would be that the Lagrangian matters, okay? So it's not just the equations of motion, but what you put into the Lagrangian, so in particular terms that you can add to the Lagrangian, which don't change the equations of motion. And in relation to this, you know, one could ask, well, what about Gauss-Bonnet or Pontryagin, which are higher derivative contributions that don't change the equations of motion. And that's something that we're looking at the moment. The second remark is that everything I mentioned today can be done also in Barnick-Brand formalism, so cohomological methods, cohomological approach. And this is this recent paper of Liveri Speciale. They have a very nice expression for this in their paper. And the final remark I wanted to make was regarding this parameter lambda, the Imidzi parameter. So if we look at this, a choice of lambda equals minus one corresponds to Ashtekar variables. And in fact, from our previous work, there's sort of two other ways in which this choice can be motivated. One is that you really need lambda to be minus one in order to reproduce these Newman-Penrose charges, so that that combination of the standard BMS charges and the Joule charges together give the 10 Newman-Penrose charges. And then, and also from this paper, whose exact title I've forgotten now, but on sort of soft theorems in the backgrounds, which we put out last year, so Hardy, Chris and I, where we really found that a consistent phase space really requires also lambda minus one. So that's sort of interesting that all roads seem to be leading to lambda minus one. Anyway, so I think I'll stop there and take some questions.
All right, so thanks very much, Maddy, for the clear presentation. And so let's start with questions now.
Yeah, I had a question.
Sure.
I think you were referring to this maybe with respect to the Speciale paper, but a lot of times when you have topological terms in the action, you can do something with corner terms that gets rid of the charges. So the question is of like, what is your prescription for fixing those corner terms, and what actually, do you know anything about for these dual magnetic charges? Does that affect things?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess we didn't in our paper give a very clear justification for all this. I mean, from our perspective, the fact that it gave us what we were looking for was somehow good enough. I mean, we were certainly aware of these ambiguities and the fact that you can just sort of add things and get rid of what, you know, you can either just inject things or take them away. What I will say, though, is that this sort of the second remark, the fact that they showed the Oliverian Speciale, showed it in the Barnick-Brandt formalism, makes this a bit more robust in the sense that this formalism really relies only on the equations of motion. It's essentially sort of Noether's second theorem based approach to charges, whereby you take the equations of motion, you act on them in some way, and you get this sort of exact form. And so that the fact that they've shown it within this formalism really makes it more robust. But in the context of what we've done, I don't think I can sort of give an honest justification for it, apart from that it gave us what we were looking for. I don't know if does that answer your question, sir?
Sort of, yeah. I'm not 100% familiar with the Barnish-Brandt, but I would think, I mean, the thing I know about the nicest way to fix those ambiguities is if you focus on either the boundary conditions or the form of the flux. And I just, some experience with like JT gravity shows that these terms that are topological sometimes can drop out if you, you know, are careful about those types of things. So I was just wondering if that sort of thing could happen here.
Yeah, so I mean, indeed we did sort of think about to try to motivate these sort of things in terms of boundary terms and so but yeah, we didn't really get anywhere. I think for me, the main sort of what I would rely on in court would be this result of this, as well as the fact that it's all consistent, right? Yeah, so I should say that in this paper where we looked at the phase space, we really found that, again, actually you need these dual charges in order for the phase space to be consistent, to be well-defined, in the sense that for the BMS group to act as you would expect on phase space variables. So there's a lot of at least indirect justifications for.
Okay, and maybe just one more quick question. You said there is like 10 Newman-Penrose charges. Are those just like 10 choices of that function, or is it something more complicated?
Indeed. So it basically boils down to taking this S to be either an L equals zero, L equals one, and an L equals two mode. I mean, it's the derivation is somewhat involved. I'm not going to be able to explain it, but it does boil down to this choice of S being these spherical harmonics and then a reality condition that brings you down from 20 to 10.
Okay.
In this sort of, this is what we showed, you know, what I showed with Hardy and Chris, that's how these Newman-Penrose charges fit into the whole BMS story. But obviously the way Newman and Penrose derived these was completely different.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, can I make a question?
Sure. I'm gonna stop sharing so that I can actually see people who are asking.
Well, wait, then I have to turn on my camera if you want to see me here.
Okay.
Thank you for the very nice talk. I wanted to learn more about the relation with the Newman-Penrose charges. Maybe if I understand correctly, you get some of them at leading order and some of them as subleading terms. Could you say more to clarify what the situation is? And some of them are electric and some of them are magnetic, you said already, but what is the status with respect to the expansion close to infinity?
Basically the way Newman and Penrose derived these was so they assume peeling the fact that, you know, the Weyl tensor components fall off in a certain way, and then they showed they continued that expansion. So instead of taking the leading order terms, they went beyond that, and they considered really the sub-leading terms, if you like, in that expansion. So when Hardy, Chris, and I started to look at this, straight away we realized that these could never come from looking at things at leading order. You really have to look at sub-leading terms. So as in go down in 1/r, and in fact, in terms of these BMS charges, so you have leading order, then at the next order, everything just vanishes. And then the order after that is somewhat between everything vanishing and not. So if you try to set the non-integrable piece to zero, you find that everything vanishes. So it's a bit sort of useless. And then it's the sort of 1/r to the 3 term, so the next term, where you see these Newman-Penrose charges coming in. And in hindsight, you would sort of have expected that from what Newman and Penrose were doing. Does that answer your question?
Sorry, wrong button. Yes, and is this true for both electric and magnetic? Namely, also the magnetic have some leading and some 1/r³ part?
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So the electric and magnetic story, as far as Newman-Penrose, is almost identical, in fact, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question as well.
I have a physical question. So does that mean we can measure now the energy parameter?
I think you would be more sort of,
physical, I'm talking about the real experiment, whether the technology allows it to do next year or 10 years from now. But since this is such a crucial parameter for the quantization of gravity, can we measure that parameter?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's not something that I'd thought about. The problem is that, so I mean, part of me would say, yeah, maybe, because you can relate everything to this memory effect and whatever, so potentially this could be measured, but I guess the effects would be so small that...
It doesn't matter. I mean,
You mean in principle? Yeah, it's a good question. It's a very good question. But as I said right at the end, I mean, it's sort of... I don't know where your loyalties lie, but certainly from our work, there seemed to be this indication that lambda equals -1 is sort of preferred, but yeah.
Well, yeah, that would mean the self-dual variables, right? Because your lambda is I gamma. So when you say lambda equal -1, you really mean you would like to use the complex theory, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So can you comment more where you say you mentioned that consistent phase space?
So this sort of goes back to a paper of Andy Strominger's from I think 2014, where they sort of looked at how the BMS charges act on phase space, and then showed that In fact, they don't reproduce sort of BMS transformations on the fields on the radiative mode. So if you look at how the BMS charge is acting on the radiative mode, it doesn't give you what you expect.
I'm not sure. Maybe it's too much of a technical. I'm not sure I completely understand what.
Let me see if I can find the archive number. I would just refer you to our paper there. Just one second, sorry. The way they got around this problem was by having some condition as a space like infinity, which from, you know, with our work, what we realized that what this condition was doing was essentially setting these dual charges off. So they were forcing these charges to be zero on phase space, which is not something you want to be doing. And certainly from a sort of well-posedness of GR, it's not something that you want to be doing. But that's what they did and found consistency. But for us, we showed that these dual charges, I'm just writing down the, oh, except I'm not sharing, right? I'll put it to share screen and write this down. So the archive number is 19080114. So this is the paper where we discuss this. What we do is that we show that when the dual charges are taken into account, and in particular with this sort of combination, then one does have a consistent action of BMS transformations on radiative modes.
By consistent, do you mean that there will be some central charge developing otherwise, or, you know, that there will be, because sometimes that's what happens when we show with Daniele that if you mix magnetic charge and electric charge, you still have a consistent quantization, but you're just developing a more complicated phase space, which has central charges, which might be, in fact, extremely interesting in terms of the, you know.
So this is a sort of more serious problem in the sense that, the action is just not what you, so for example in these metric components that I wrote down, in particular the radiative mode is given by this CIJ, what I call CIJ, and if you look at how the BMS how it transforms under the action of BMS generators, it transforms in a particular way, but on phase space, if you look at the action of that charge on this, it doesn't transform in that way. I mean, inconsistent in that sense, that there's a clash, basically, that doesn't make sense. Central
charge. Does that mean the clash, can it be interpreted as an anomaly? Like usually it is true that the Poisson bracket is not exactly equal to the bracket of the Poisson. You know, algebra.
Yeah, that's, up to
anomaly. This is a very important term for Virasoro. So usually these anomaly terms are in fact extremely, I mean, maybe I'm not, I don't know if it's, so this inconsistency could be a source of a very important observable.
That's a fair point, yeah. That's a fair point.
Okay. I thought Lee would take, he's not there, but observability of Imirzi parameter. Anybody interested in quantum gravity?
I'm here, well, go ahead.
No, we're talking about the potential that the Imirzi parameter now is an observable.
How? By measuring some parity artifacts?
No, by measuring asymptotic flux, by measuring something at LIGO or LISA. Like, you know, in a real experiment.
Good, go, keep going.
I mean,
no, I know how to think about it in terms of early universe cosmology and BMO.
But really, do that. I mean, before, didn't you say that the flux associated to these charges actually vanish?
Indeed. So if you look at the global part, the not charge essentially, and you look at the continuity equation for that, you'll find that it is just conserved, right? Which is what you expect, because the node charge is a topological feature of your space-time, and it's going to be there. So while I was just pointing out that there's this interesting aspect that while for both the standard and the Joule BMS charges, there's this non-integrable piece. Just because of the structure of the non-integrable piece, the fact that in one you have a twist, it means that when you translate these expressions to continuity equations on one for the standard BMS, it translates directly to Bondi flux, and for the other, it would just be zero.
So, in which sense can you talk about memory effect for these charges?
No, but he showed that the local charge have a flux, so there is a memory. Yeah. The mass. The mass is conserved, but the mass doesn't contain the radiative mode.
So it's really the global part that's conserved, but
okay.
Half of fluxes.
I think someone else was trying to ask a question earlier. I'm not sure who was it.
Yes, Daniela, it was me. My camera does not work, so I cannot.
Hello.
But yeah, I already discussed it. Essentially, the question was about the flux of these dual charges, because, as you said already, you can try to express the flux in terms of the radiative multiple moments, and in this way you can have a chance to, you know, to link it to observations.
But
Friedel and Daniel already comment about it. So thanks anyway for the talk. Very nice.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, so let's thank Mandy again.